KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
History was made in this building. It has been the epicenter of the civil rights movement.
The Claiborne Temple in Memphis was a landmark of the civil rights movement. It was destroyed by a fire this morning.
For Monday, April 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has started a national conversation about autism.
Will that lead to more support for people affected by the disorder?
We don't have enough resources. We don't have enough clinicians. We don't have enough housing.
Plus, the end of the Deaf Scientist Pipeline.
That is a federal grant program for deaf students to study science, a program that's now been shut down by the Trump administration.
And we pay a visit to a vending machine where four quarters will buy you a piece of art.
People have been calling them Pokemon cards for women.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Ukraine is questioning why Russia won't start a ceasefire immediately instead of waiting until May 8th when Moscow holds a military parade to mark the Soviet Union's victory over the Nazis. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv.
Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a halt in Russian military activities for 72 hours starting on March 8th. He said he expects Ukraine to do the same. In his nightly video address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine has not wanted even a second of this war and is pushing for Russia to accept an immediate, unconditional 30-day ceasefire brokered by the U.S. last month. We value human lives, not parades, Zelensky said. That's why we believe there's no reason to wait. The firing should not stop for a few days, only for the killing to start again. Zelensky says peace talks can only begin once a durable ceasefire is in place. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
President Trump has decided to give automakers a break on some of his tariffs. That's according to an administration official speaking on condition of anonymity. Formal announcements expected tomorrow ahead of Trump's rally in Michigan. As first reported by the Wall Street Journal, the move will ensure different types of tariffs charged by the administration don't stack up on top of other tariffs he's already imposed. Importers of foreign auto parts will be able to get some reimbursement for the next 2 years. The break will both reward domestic manufacturers while providing a runway to those needing time to invest in domestic plants. Attorneys for a prominent law firm are urging a federal judge to strike down President Trump's executive order against the firm. The order's punitive measures include suspending security clearances for the firm employees and barring personnel from access to government buildings. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Attorneys representing the law firm of Jenner and Block say Trump's executive order violates the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. They say it is designed to punish the firm for representing clients in causes the president doesn't like. At a hearing in federal court, an attorney for the firm said the order reeks of unconstitutionality and urged the court to permanently block it in its entirety. The Justice Department, in contrast, argues that the order falls under the legal discretion of the executive branch. Jenner is one of four firms targeted for punishment by Trump that are suing to challenge the executive orders. Other firms have cut deals with Trump to avoid possible retribution. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The power is gradually coming back after a blackout that brought much of Spain and Portugal to a standstill. The cause still not clear, though officials have referred to a strong oscillation in the European power grid as possibly being behind the outage. Actual cause has not been determined. The outage has affected millions, halting train services and forcing airports, hospitals, and emergency services to operate on backup power. The Dow is up 114 points. This is NPR. President Trump welcomed the Super Bowl-winning Philadelphia Eagles to the White House today, but several players, most notably star quarterback Jalen Hurts, apparently had something else to do. Hurts citing scheduling conflicts as the reason for his absence, though a similar celebration in 2018 was canceled during Trump's first term when it became clear players would not be showing up. One person who did show up and who even hitched a ride aboard Air Force One, Eagles star running back Saquon Barkley, on social media he noted he, quote, respects the office. Three former Memphis police officers are on trial for a second time for their involvement in the beating death of black motorist Tyree Nichols. Katie Reardon from member station WKNO reports opening statements began today for the second-degree murder case.
The former officers, who are also black, were additionally accused of federal crimes during a trial last fall. Two were found guilty of witness tampering, and one was also convicted of violating Nichols' civil rights by using excessive force and ignoring his medical needs. The men, along with two other colleagues, were captured on body-worn cameras and surveillance footage, either restraining, kicking, or hitting Nichols following a traffic stop in January of 2023. He died in the hospital 3 days later. Two of the officers pleaded guilty to federal charges and intend to also plead guilty in state court. The state trial is expected to last 2 weeks. For NPR News, I'm Katie Reardon.
Crude oil futures prices moved lower today amid ongoing worries and uncertainty over the outcome of a U.S.-China trade fight. Oil was down 97 cents a barrel to end the session at $62.05 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. As we near 100 days of the second Trump administration, we also near 100 days of DOGE. The ad hoc Department of Government Efficiency team is one of the defining initiatives of President Trump's term so far. DOGE has not really delivered on its promised savings, efficiency, or transparency goals in meaningful ways. It has amassed unprecedented power over sensitive personal data the government maintains. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been tracking this. Hi.
Hey there.
So, Stephen, let's start here. Is the federal government more efficient with DOGE?
Not really, Juana. I mean, there hasn't been meaningful progress on DOGE's mandate to cut government spending or improve how it operates. Billionaire Elon Musk's vision of taking a chainsaw to the multi-trillion dollar budget has hit repeated snags. Many of DOGE's efforts to push agencies to fire workers or shut down programs have been blocked by the courts and been unpopular in the court of public opinion. And that work has been largely done in secret, with countless anecdotes of inefficiency dominating reporting we've done, like probationary employees that were fired, rehired, and fired again, people told to return to office work with shortages of desks, internet bandwidth, and even toilet paper, and claims to save money by cutting contracts that made things more efficient.
Okay, I want to zoom in on savings here. One of the key planks of DOGE was this intent to cut $1 trillion of federal spending this budget year. So tell us, how's it going?
Well, the biggest cut so far has been to their own savings goals. A few weeks ago, Musk revised that savings estimate down to $150 billion. Even then, there's little evidence that that is achievable. One, the federal government spends more money than it brings in. In fact, Treasury Department data says spending is up 10% from this time last year. And two, as we've reported, DOGE's savings tracker on their website is riddled with errors, inaccuracies, and opaque methodology. For example, I looked over the weekend, and the five biggest savings claims for contracts includes one contract that was never awarded, one that was already terminated, and one contract that doesn't seem to be canceled at all.
So another thing DOGE has done is work to combine government data that doesn't normally go together. How controversial has that project been?
DOGE has amassed this unprecedented power over the most sensitive data the government collects on Americans and from Americans, like social security numbers and bank accounts and other things that are supposed to be kept private. A small number of engineers and others with ties to Musk have been using that data access to connect the dots to help policy aims, especially around immigration. There's been a push to share immigration-related data from the IRS, Social Security Administration, and other agencies to help aid in the Trump administration's deportation push. The Department of Homeland Security also announced last week that DOGE helped overhaul an immigration database that will serve as, quote, a single reliable source for verifying non-citizen status nationwide. There's also been more than a dozen court cases, Juana, where judges have repeatedly expressed concern over who has that data and how it's being used, and the ways in which it's being shared potentially violates federal law and risk exposure of that data outside of its intended use.
Stephen, we know that Elon Musk has said that he will step back from Doge in the coming weeks. So tell us, how might that change Doge's work?
Well, in many ways, it's not going to change things. I mean, Musk has been the face of Doge, but there's been his allies that have been working in these federal agencies. They are now employees of the agencies. They are still working with the agencies. They'll be the ones carrying out the mission. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. President Trump gave a deadline of July 4th, 2026 for Doge's work. But even after that work's done, there are long-term changes that would be hard to unwind. Things like ending scientific research funding, reducing foreign policy footprint for America, and the loss of institutional knowledge from some of the 100,000 workers so far that have been fired or chosen to leave the federal government.
NPR's Stephen Fowler in Atlanta. He is part of a team of reporters across NPR's newsroom covering government restructuring and the impact of DOGE. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
A key civil rights landmark in Memphis, Tennessee, was destroyed in a fire overnight. The historic Claiborne Temple was the staging ground for striking sanitation workers during their iconic I Am a Man campaign. That's the campaign that drew Martin Luther King Jr. to Memphis. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The stone bell tower of Claiborne Temple has been a stately fixture in downtown Memphis for more than 130 years. But residents awoke this morning to a devastating fire in the historic AME church.
Heartbreaking to see one of the nation's greatest treasures lost to this fire.
Memphis Mayor Paul Young.
It has been a really, really important part of the story of our city and the story of our nation.
In 1968, Memphis sanitation workers walked off the job to protest dangerous and deadly working conditions after two trash collectors were killed on duty. The Claiborne Temple offered a place for civil rights and labor activists to meet and plan. It was close to City Hall, and the pastor had a printing press. Mayor Young says preserving the legacy of what happened there matters.
History was made in this building. It has been the epicenter of the civil rights movement. The I Am a Man signs that became so prominent during the civil rights movement, they were made in the basement of that facility. The strategy that was put in place for the marches, they took place right there in that facility.
The late Reverend James Lawson helped map strategy for the strike and what became their I Am a Man campaign from the Claiborne Temple. Here he is speaking back then.
Well, at the heart of racism is the idea that a man is not a man.
Lawson recruited the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to come help lead marches, and it was during that campaign that he was assassinated in Memphis on April 4th, 1968. 50 years later, it was the bell from Claiborne Temple that rang out 39 times, once for each year of King's life, as the city marked the anniversary of his death. Claiborne Temple closed in 1999 and the building deteriorated for years, but over the last 10, there's been new investment to restore the historic sanctuary led by the nonprofit that now owns it. The group's founder, Anasa Troutman, says it's significant because King saw the movement there as part of his larger campaign to organize across race and class to fight poverty.
When he looked at Memphis and the strike and the work that was happening in Claiborne Temple, he saw the future of America.
Claiborne Temple's bell tower was smoldering but standing by mid-afternoon as state and federal investigators were on site to look for clues as to what happened. Claiborne is in the heart of the Memphis Heritage Trail, and people have been drawn there today to what many consider sacred ground. Troutman is moved by the outpouring.
people whose grandparents were sanitation workers, people who worshiped in the church, people who were christened in the church, people whose family members were eulogized in the church. It's been a steady flow of people all day. And that is the hardest part, is seeing people come and greet their spiritual home. It's just a lot.
She says work will continue to make sure Claiborne Temple remains an international beacon of resilience, faith, and the beloved community. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Alexis Agnew. In 2018, when Agnew was 24 years old, she went to her doctor for a routine health screening. One of her tests revealed an irregularity, and the doctor recommended a follow-up biopsy. Agnew was terrified she might have cancer.
And because I expected nothing special, I did not bring anybody to my appointment, so I was alone. And as I was passing the front desk out of the building, I was oscillating between bawling and being numb and zombified, and bawling and numb and zombified. And as I passed the front desk, the attendant there, she was an older lady, probably 60. She was eating her lunch, but when she saw me, she stopped me and asked, "What's the matter, baby? Are you okay?" Well, I guess just being acknowledged was enough for me, so I started crying because I was explaining to her that I was indeed not okay, and she listened the whole time. And after I had finished talking, she asked me if I wanted a hug, and I lost it. I just started crying, so she pulled me close, and she held me, as I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And to be honest, I don't know if that was 30 seconds or 3 minutes. All I know is I sat there in the middle of that busy hospital, just bawling in the stranger's arms. And so after I had calmed down a bit, she turned to me and said, "All right, baby, let's pray." So we did. And after we prayed, she shared with me that I was the same age as her granddaughter, and she just hates seeing a young person so devastated, so broken up. But then she told me that she knew I'd be okay, and I believe her. Believed her then, believe her now. Now, I'm happy to report that I have not had to go back to that hospital because, praise the Lord, my biopsy came back clean. Came back clear. I was cancer-free, no issues. Just a fluke. But if I ever did have to return, and if I ever saw that wonderful woman again, there's not enough words for how many ways I'd want to thank her. I could not thank her enough. But I would try anyway.
Alexis Agnew of Little Rock, Arkansas. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamoodbell.com/NPR.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Secretary of Health and Human Services, says that by September, his agency will begin to have answers to the question of what causes autism. When he announced this initiative earlier this month, here is how he characterized people with autism.
And these are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted.
That is not true for many autistic people, and his language was widely criticized as insensitive, as stigmatizing. It is true, though, that about a quarter of those diagnosed with autism are profoundly affected by the disorder. And I want to bring in one of their advocates to help us better understand the secretary's remarks. Jill Escher is president of the National Council on Severe Autism. Jill Escher, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So it feels important to acknowledge just at the very start that autism has such a range of manifestations, from people who are nonverbal, who will need lifetime support, to people who have autism and it might not be evident to those who don't know them. How did Secretary Kennedy's remarks land with you?
Well, certainly, I think everybody in this field knew that those remarks didn't apply to the broad spectrum of autism, but they certainly do apply to a very significant subset of us. And that would include my own two kids who are adults now with nonverbal profound autism. I mean, they're never going to write a poem. They don't even know what a poem is. They're not going to play baseball. I don't think they'd ever be able to hold a bat appropriately. And they definitely need some assistance with toileting and all their hygiene. So it's not like these comments were at all shocking to a very broad swath of the autism population.
So to dig in a bit more on what Secretary Kennedy said, he also said his agency is going to study which environmental toxins cause autism. For starters, is that the right framing, in your view, for the science here?
Well, I think that Kennedy is asking the right big question, which is, what is behind these regularly increasing rates of autism in our children? And he also emphasized how true those rates are, that this is truly an epidemic. He used the E word, which is the appropriate word to use. He had a sense of urgency about it, which is appropriate and necessary. But then he turned to, you know, the idea of environmental toxins maybe being a culprit here. Now, I think there has been quite a bit of research on autism causation over the past two decades. Mm-hmm. And we have learned pretty emphatically that things like mold, things like ultrasounds, you know, things in our water and air are not causing autism. So I would rule out a lot of the factors that he gave some lip service to. However, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking for other things that maybe he didn't discuss. It's really important to have a strong science agenda behind finding the risk factors for autism. The question is, how do you stick very close to what we've already learned in scientific endeavors and really find the hypotheses that are worth exploring? The ones he mentioned, I'm not so sure are.
I want to square what you're saying with the latest CDC report, which acknowledges, yes, autism rates are on the rise. Their findings are that now 1 in 31 children across the U.S. Have autism. But the report also says the increase is probably largely due to doctors getting better at screening, at diagnosing, at seeing what was always there. How do we square that with what you have just told me?
You can look at the short term or you can look at the long term. In the short term, you know, year over year, you might see some effects of better screening, better diagnosis. But we are talking about an increase that has been occurring since the early 90s with very significant increases of about 7% a year. And there is just nothing in the base of evidence that suggests that this sweeping increase is owing to these sort of diagnostic or sociological factors. We see increases in autism even when you limit it to the most profound forms of autism, even if you limit it to autism with intellectual disability. So it's not just that we're capturing milder cases. That's not it at all.
So let me turn us from causation two questions about, so what do we do? What sort of support systems need to be developed? Because I knew your organization is calling for comprehensive support systems. What, in your view, is needed? What would it look like?
Yes, I think what alarmed people was that RFK Jr. made these remarks about the autism epidemic, but that wasn't joined by a sense of alarm about the need for ongoing lifespan care. We don't have enough resources. We don't have enough clinicians. We don't have enough therapies. We don't have enough housing options at all. I mean, when we poll parents, parents are absolutely panicked about the future because they look in front of them and they don't see a roadmap for their children as they grow older. And this is a national crisis. So it would be nice if, as we talked about the rising rates of autism, we would also open the floodgates to more and more services and supports.
When you're calling for better support for people with autism, we are living in a moment where we see the federal government trying to cut costs, not trying to add spending. Realistically, is more help coming?
Unfortunately, right now, the system is already broken. You know, families that are experiencing, immense trauma are not getting the help they need. And the prospect of seeing the situation worsen is terrifying to people in our community. Ultimately, I know that it's not politically fashionable, but we will need to see more funding go, especially to the adults with disabling autism. The data doesn't lie. The data is there. It's easy to project, and we will need that.
It's such an interesting moment with so much focus, so much conversation on autism right now. What is that like for you?
Oh, I think it's an excellent thing for the country. I really do. I think we have to have this moment. We have to have a reckoning about the reality of the autism increase. And while people have good reason to criticize RFK Jr. for many things, I don't think he should be criticized for this. He is doing the country a big favor. We have to have serious discussions about causation. We have to have serious discussions about revising policy to meet the needs. We should not be romanticizing autism. I mean, yes, of course. I mean, I love my children with autism to pieces. I love my autism community. But we have to be realistic about what's going on. Autism is, by definition, a serious neurodevelopmental disability, and there's no reason to be normalizing it when we still have so many unanswered questions about what might be causing it and what we should be doing about it.
Jill Escher is president of the National Council on Severe Autism. Jill Escher, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We have the first interview with any of the students who've been detained here in the U.S. and threatened with deportation, ostensibly over their pro-Palestinian advocacy. Mohsen Mahdawi thought he was going to be a citizen.
When I get the appointment, the first thing was, is this a trap or is it legit?
Now he's at a correctional facility. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Got a question about Social Security benefits?
Get ready to wait as workforce cuts sink in and remaining staffers struggle to keep up.
This is not only a waste in terms of the expertise that we are driving out of the agency, but it is an actual loss of efficiency.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The White House is marking President Trump's first 100 days in office this week, touting its crackdown on illegal immigration, as well as efforts to cut the federal government's payroll while shrinking agencies and eliminating programs. Trump advisor Elon Musk and his Doge workers have amassed unprecedented access to some of the most sensitive data the government collects on Americans, including Social Security numbers and bank accounts that are supposed to be kept private. NPR's Stephen Fowler says Doge has not really delivered on its promised savings.
There hasn't been meaningful progress on Doge's mandate to cut government spending or improve how it operates. Billionaire Elon Musk's vision of taking a chainsaw to the multi-trillion dollar budget has hit repeated snags. Many of Doge's efforts to push agencies to fire workers or shut down programs have been blocked by the courts and been unpopular in the court of public opinion.
NPR's Stephen Fowler. In the last 3 months, the federal government has canceled about $11 billion worth of university research funding. But as NPR's Alyssa Natwerny tells us, there's really no other entity positioned to pick up the void.
Cancer research, research in new wearable technology and jet engines and farming solutions, a broad range will be impacted. Dozens of colleges and universities have had research funds frozen because of the shuttering of federal departments like USAID and in response to alleged anti-Semitism on campus. But researchers say if the federal government gets out of the university research funding, there won't be anyone else to step in. Sabrina Howell, a professor of finance at NYU, says industry is focused on outputs, what they can sell.
Whereas government is investing in innovation in order to benefit society and the U.S. at large.
Alyssa Nadorny, NPR News.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today. This is NPR. The Pakistani army has killed more than 70 people it claims were militants loyal to an offshoot of the Taliban. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
It was the biggest death toll of alleged militants in years, and Pakistan's military claimed, without evidence, that India was backing the men. Tensions have been high between the two countries since a militant attack last Tuesday killed 26 people, mostly Hindu men in Indian-controlled Kashmir. India blamed Pakistan for the attack. Pakistan denies any connection to the militants. Soon after the army made the announcement, Pakistani media reported that a bombing killed 7 men in a district that borders Afghanistan. The men belong to a committee that tries to prevent militants from infiltrating their remote areas. Security has been eroding along Pakistan's borders since the Taliban seized power of Afghanistan nearly 3 years ago. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
More than 55,000 county workers here in Los Angeles are poised to walk off the job tonight. Non-urgent health clinics, public libraries, wildfire cleanup, and trash pickup could be put on hold if a new contract isn't reached shortly. The union workers claim unfair labor practices by the county and want higher wages and vacancies filled. The county says they can't afford any raises at this time. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Thousands of employees have left the Social Security Administration in recent weeks. It is part of the Trump administration's effort to decrease the federal government workforce. But remaining Social Security staffers say they're struggling to keep up with the agency's important work for millions of Americans. NPR's Ashley Lopez joins us now to explain how staff cuts are impacting services. Hi there.
Hey there.
So, Ashley, let's start with the worker cuts there at Social Security. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about who's left so far?
Yeah, so 2 months ago, the agency announced it plans to cut 12% of its staff, which is about 7,000 jobs. And so far, we know that almost 3,000 employees at the agency have left or plan to leave. And what has stood out to people monitoring these departures is that roughly 2,000 of them worked in local field offices, which are basically the main point of contact at Social Security for most Americans.
Do you have any sense as to whether these departures are affecting services locally?
Well, it's a big hit for any community who has lost people in these roles because field office workers handle things like Social Security cards, retirement, as well as disability and survivor claims. And depending where you live, your local office might have actually lost a big chunk of its workers. Union officials told me there are about 40 field offices that have lost at least 25% of their staff so far, and others have lost half or more of their workers. These union officials say the agency was already at a 50-year staffing low, so these new cuts could lead to an increase in wait time for both in-person and phone services.
Ashley, we've heard President Trump say many times that he was not going to cut Social Security. So what has the administration said about how things are going at the Social Security Agency?
Yeah, and the Trump administration has continued to say it won't cut benefits, but is instead focused on cutting waste and fraud from the program. But people who work at the agency, as well as advocates for older and disabled Americans, say these staff cuts make it harder to get benefits. That's something Jessica LaPointe told me. She worked at a local field office in Madison, Wisconsin for 16 years.
The cut to the program is the deterioration of staff. That is the backdoor cut to the program because benefits delayed are benefits denied.
A spokesperson for the agency told me in a statement that their overall workforce plan is aimed at reducing people in those non-critical roles and at some point shoring up staff in those field offices.
Do we have any idea of what the agency's plans are for how to do that?
Yeah, so the agency asked people working in sort of upper management positions to volunteer for reassignment. And so far, more than 2,000 people have volunteered. But it's like an open question on how this transition will actually go. Laura Holtzel worked at the agency's headquarters analyzing policy and services, but she decided to retire early instead of dealing with all the uncertainty of being reassigned. Holtzel told me it takes years to become proficient in all of these jobs.
This is not only a waste in terms of the expertise that we are driving out of the agency, but it is an actual loss of efficiency by replacing those experts with people who need 2 years of training to get up to speed to do the job well.
And this is a larger critique of how the Trump administration has carried out its mission of rooting out waste in the federal government. People like LaPointe and Holtzel said this actually is not going to make important agencies like Social Security work better. Instead, they say it's going to make it harder for the many Americans who rely on those services to actually get help.
NPR's Ashley Lopez. Ashley, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
When deaf students get out of college, they are less likely to find jobs in the sciences or healthcare or teaching. So for years, the U.S. government tried to change that and gave grants to deaf students, grants that have just been ended by the Trump administration. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
In high school, Sarah Blick-Nitko discovered her love for science, but she didn't know if there was any future in it. She was the one deaf kid at her high school.
Who are our role models?
That's an interpreter voicing what Blick-Nitko says in American Sign Language.
Growing up, I never met another deaf person working in the science field.
Today, she's got her PhD in pathology and works in a laboratory researching treatments for cancer. It was possible because of something called
the Deaf Scientist Pipeline. is something I can talk about all day.
That's a series of federal grants to deaf students to study science in high school, as college undergraduates, in graduate school, and now for Blick-Nitko as a scientist in a postdoctoral program. The grants pay for things like scholarships, sign language interpretation, travel to professional conferences. But the Trump administration just ended those programs in the deaf scientist pipeline. Blick-Nitko's future just got cloudy. Her lab director says he'll try to find other money to let her finish the last year of her postdoctoral fellowship. For 24-year-old Matthew Peeks, at the start of his career, things are much more uncertain. Peeks felt he'd found his calling when late last year he went to work at a school for deaf students in New York City. He's a classroom instructional aide. He helps the high school students and teachers.
It's fun to work with what I consider to be very, very intelligent people. Everybody's very passionate about their jobs, and everybody really cares about these students and wants the best for them.
And Peeks seems like a good fit. He's the son of two deaf parents. He grew up fluent in American Sign Language. Now he wants to get his master's degree and move up to become a teacher. But the federal grant program he applied for to train teachers of deaf students just got canceled. It was at Teachers College at Columbia University. Peeks can't afford the tuition without that scholarship.
I definitely feel like if things had been different, I wouldn't be feeling so lost and unsure about my future.
These are small programs, a few million dollars a year. The U.S. Department of Education did not reply to a request to explain why the program for training teachers was ended. But the National Institutes of Health, which funded the Deaf Scientist Pipeline, did respond and explained it is taking action to terminate research funding that is not aligned with the administration's priorities to, quote, directly affect the health of Americans. Gerard Buckley says the health of Americans will be affected. He's the president of the National Technical Institute for the Deaf, a science and technology college at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Buckley helped build the Deaf Scientist Pipeline. Now he's telling his students the money is gone.
They're naturally upset. They tried to train for these careers and really believed they were doing the right thing. They were ready to contribute to the sciences and the treatment of diseases, a variety of things.
The canceled programs, including ones called URISE and BRIDGES, were set up to help anyone from an underrepresented group, disabled, Black, Latino, people who are the first in their family to go to college. The American Public Health Association and other plaintiffs have sued the Trump administration to restore these and other research and education grants. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A new batch of musicians is headed to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, including a major 80s pop star, a groundbreaking Southern rap duo, and a 60s dance icon who spent years lobbying for his own induction. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has the rundown.
There are seven performers who will join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They joined the 255 artists who are already in the hall, ranging from rock and roll founders like Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley through 21st century artists like Missy Elliott. In recent years, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has expanded the definition of its namesake genre, but it's still letting in straight ahead rock acts like the classic rockers, Bad Company. I can't get enough of your love. Bad Company has been eligible since 1999, but was nominated for the first time this year. Grunge pioneers Soundgarden are also on the list. So is the legendary Southern rap duo Outkast. Ain't nobody, no business. Made up of Big Boi and Andre 3000, OutKast put Atlanta on hip-hop's map with albums like AT Aliens, Stankonia, and Speakerbox, The Love Below. This year, they'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So will the rainbow-haired pop star Cyndi Lauper, who rose to stardom on 80s dance floors and on MTV with hits like this one. If you love, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. Also getting inducted is the late English singer Joe Cocker. Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. Cocker became a star in the US with this raspy rendition of the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends at Woodstock in 1969. But he went on to release more than 40 albums, spawning hits like Feeling All Right and You Are So Beautiful. Artists are eligible for the Rock Hall 25 years after their first commercial release. And the youngest, by that criteria, is the White Stripes. The guitar, drums, and vocal duo were at the forefront of the garage rock revival of the early 2000s. The artist who waited the longest for his nomination is Chubby Checker. He danced his way to the very top of the Billboard Hot 100 with this cover of The Twist in 1960. In 2001, Chubby Checker took out a full-page ad in Billboard magazine saying he felt underappreciated for his contributions to rock and roll. He adamantly requested his own induction into the Rock Hall, writing, quote, "I want my flowers while I'm alive. I can't smell them when I'm dead." It's been more than two decades, but the bouquet is finally on its way. Each year, in addition to the inductees named by the Hall's voters, a few musicians are also included as musical influences. This year's honored artists are the groundbreaking female rap group Salt-N-Pepa and the 70s and 80s rock songwriter Warren Zevon. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place on November 8th in Los Angeles. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A town in the Israeli-occupied West Bank with close ties to the United States was shattered this month. One of its children, a 14-year-old Palestinian-American from New Jersey, was shot and killed by Israeli forces. Residents of the town say the U.S. government does not do enough to defend them as compared to their Israeli-American counterparts. NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi reports.
A United States flag flaps in the wind at the gate of Mohammed Rabia's house. He was born in Turmus Aya, a town of about 5,000 in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. But he, like many others, spent time in the U.S. raising a family.
We are American and Palestinian, my country here and there.
The mayor of Turmus Aya says about 80% of the town are dual U.S. citizens. It's dubbed Little America. About a decade ago, Rabia says he decided to bring his family back to his ancestral town.
To know their second country, and we have a farm here, we have a house.
Residents here are doctors, lawyers, and businessmen, many with U.S. degrees. The town has farms, sprawling villas, and luxury cars. But since the Gaza war broke out in October of 2023, life hasn't been easy. More than 800 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by Israeli forces or Jewish settlers, according to the United Nations. Rabia recounts how on April 6th, his own son, 14-year-old Amr, became one of those victims.
6:20, I receive a call. They saying some people get shot and maybe your son with him.
That call came from neighbors who said Israeli forces were shooting where he knew his son often plays. Rabia says he became very worried. His first instinct was to call the U.S. Embassy for help. But he says an embassy official kept putting him on hold and it was taking too long. Rabia says finally, local officials told him to pick up his son's body from a nearby Israeli army base.
It was him, as he was all naked inside a blue bag. I kiss him and I say, Alhamdulillah, thanks God.
NPR reached out to the U.S. Embassy. It didn't comment about Rabia's complaints. Palestinian-American advocate Yasser Alqam says he's disappointed the embassy didn't do more. He says the U.S. government turns a blind eye to how Israeli forces treat Palestinian-Americans.
This is the only country where the U.S. passport gets stepped on with impunity. They stop you at a checkpoint and you show them your U.S. passport and they throw it into your face.
Alqam retired in Turmus Aya after years as a lawyer in Anaheim, California. He says there's a double standard when it comes to the U.S. treating Israeli Americans versus Palestinian Americans. The U.S. Embassy did not respond to NPR's request for comment on that accusation. Amr's father, Mohammed Rabia, agrees. He says, look at how much pressure the U.S. is applying to free an Israeli American hostage currently held in Gaza.
Trump talking about Netanyahu called their family. Why Trump didn't call me?
Amr is now one of five U.S. citizens the State Department says have been killed by Israelis in the West Bank since October 7th of 2023. In those cases, no soldier or settler implicated have been prosecuted. In Rabia's son's case, Israel says soldiers opened fire at three people hurling rocks at a highway. Israel said it would not conduct an investigation into what they called a counterterrorism operation. Ayub Asad is the sole survivor of the shooting. He's 14 and says he was just picking almonds with his friends when soldiers started shooting. Asad, who was born in Tennessee, is recovering at his home in Turmus Aya. He's very weak. Asad says he didn't realize he was shot until he saw his shirt soaked in blood. His family says U.S. embassy officials told them it would conduct an investigation. But when contacted by NPR, the embassy said there was, quote, nothing to announce at this time. Palestinian-American advocate Yasser Alqam says the U.S. needs to do more for its citizens in the West Bank.
We want protection. We ask the Trump administration to at least pressure Israel, hands off Palestinian-Americans.
But for 14-year-old Asad, all he really wants is his best friend back. I tell him to come back to us. We miss you. Hadil El-Shalchi, NPR News, Turmus Aya, in the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
What comes to mind when you see a vending machine? Bad coffee, maybe stale chips. You might not be thinking about snagging a work of art, but one artist is trying to make vending machines a bit more creative. All Things Considered producer Jordan Marie Smith brings us the story.
At the National Museum of Women in the Arts in Washington, D.C., next to a gift shop, there's a line forming for a vending machine.
Okay, here it is. It's bright red with three slots. Each slot has a space for four quarters. The machine is around, is that 3 feet?
That's printmaker Anand Ciardi. Four quarters won't get you a snack in our vending machines, but it will get you a colorful 3x5 print. Often a food, maybe a Cornichon pickle, a purple cabbage, or even a vibrantly orange pumpkin.
My wife is a farmer, and she will like come home with a bounty of vegetables, and then how could I not create 100 different prints of tomatoes?
Those prints of tiny edibles spawned a whole community of dedicated Anand Ciardi fans. They collect and trade her $1 artworks, and there's even a subreddit for them. Right now, there are 50 of her mini print vending machines across the United States, but Ciardi still gets excited about seeing them in real life.
This is my first time at this museum. It's the first time seeing this vending machine. It's always really sweet watching people, but I always like shed a little tear the first time I see it. It's really cute. It's really, really cute.
That day, a handful of people were waiting in line just to buy their very own mini print. Ciardi spoke with Ariane Mott.
What did you guys get?
I got a martini, which I'm very excited about, and a strawberry.
You get matching. Is this your first time going to a machine?
But my friend got me the strawberry like a couple weeks ago, and I want to just go for myself.
Okay, good.
This is talk of the town.
Mott says she and her friends gush over collecting Ciardi's prints.
My friends will go and then like get a bunch, and then we'll all like get our prints.
People have been calling them Pokemon cards for women.
Nice.
Ciardi got the idea to put her art in vending machines back in 2020, but it was only out of necessity. A necessity for, well, clean clothes.
We have coin-operated laundry in our basement, and we couldn't find quarters anywhere because there was a big coin shortage during 2020. Yeah. And I was like, what if I had like a little vending machine where I could collect quarters through my laundry?
Oh my god!
And that was literally how I came up with it.
The prints are deeply nostalgic to her.
There is this sticker and tattoo vending machine at a supermarket near where I grew up in Brooklyn, at Key Food on 7th Avenue, Carroll Street. And I would get like a Batman or like a Spider-Man tattoo out of that thing. And then I was like, I wonder if I could get one of those to sell my little prints in there. And now that's how I do my laundry still.
Ciardi hopes to expand internationally, but still keep the cost of her mini prints accessible. Jordan Marie Smith, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the John D. and